Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sign Guy Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday afternoon. Sign Guy and QT with you once again. Before we bring our guests on, if you're looking for some pro wrestling in the next couple of days, lots out there. Tonight, WCWO, like usual, at the Outlaw Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. GCCW in Alberta, Alabama. Hood Slam in Oakland, California. NEW in Waterbury, Connecticut. The NWA in Franklin, Kentucky. BCW in Elmhurst, New York. VOW in Fairmont, West Virginia. Tomorrow night, HPW running in Columbus, Indiana at the HPW Arena. Emerge also in Columbus tomorrow night. Up in our neck of the woods, the return of Chief Atakula Kula to the NWWA in Portland, Oregon. All cage show for that. ECCW in Vancouver, British Columbia. NEW in Golden, Colorado. AAW in LaSalle, Illinois. SCW in Dubuque, Iowa. IPW in Algona, Iowa. AMW in Hazard, Kentucky. WWA in Central City, Kentucky. ACCW in Taylorsville, North Carolina. NAWA in Drexel, North Carolina. AIWF in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The NWA in Amarillo, Texas. TASW in Houston, Texas. UCW in Salt Lake City, Utah. ACW in Stevens, Pennsylvania. And RCCW in Green, Alabama tomorrow, featuring our guest on Sunday, Damon Crow. So get out there, find some wrestling near you, and support it. Without further ado, I would like to welcome on our guest this afternoon from the great state of Arizona. Welcome to the show, CC Star.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for asking me to come and talk to you today. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure to have you on the show today. And since it's your first time with us, first question is the traditional first-timer's question. What led to you getting into the business of pro wrestling?
It started out, I was an amateur wrestler as a kid. I grew up on the mats. I was always a fan of pro wrestling. I didn't know what to do or how to get into it. So at the time of 16, I started pounding on doors, the local wrestling federation around local wrestling promotion in Arizona to try and get a way in, and carried a lot of ring jackets and set up rings and stuff like that, and was lucky enough to get brought into a wrestler who was a boxing trainer. His name was Pablo Kitonen. He trained fighters for years and years and years in the Valley. He was a pro wrestler, and he was what we call in the old days, what they call a hooker. So he was a legitimate tough guy. He had wrestled guys like, Lou Fez and Vic Christie. But he, trained fighters. I was able to convince him to, train me, in pro wrestling. The deal was that I had to go and train boxing from 7 to 10 every night at the boxing gym, and I had to pay for that, which was like $20 a month. And then after 10 o'clock, he'd teach me for an hour a night about pro wrestling, which consisted of him stretching the hell out of me pretty much for 60 minutes. But he taught me how to wrestle. He's the one that taught me how to be a pro wrestler. And I absolutely am grateful to him, because it was his knowledge in teaching me actual real wrestling and catch wrestling, teaching me that old school way that having that knowledge was a skill that came in handy over the course of my career. I didn't get messed with a lot because of that. But yeah, that's how it started out. It started out at 16.
Now, at the time that you were starting, pro wrestling was in a boom period. It was huge, lots of national exposure, but there were still full-time territories for the most part. When you started out, were you able to do sort of the territorial system in pro wrestling, or was it more closely resembling the independent structure?
No, see, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, originally the NWA was the power promotion in all the world. The NWA, of course, was a cooperative, a conglomerate of tons of different wrestling promotions all over the world. They all paid to the NWA, and in return, the champion would come and stuff like that. And they were able to, you know, when those guys had relationships with each other, they had talents and stuff like that that they could share. So at the time, it was a great experience for me to learn. I could go do jobs and go work and learn in Portland and in Arizona. Out here, there was an NWA promotion. In California, could go to work for them in Mexico, you know, in Texas. There was, and in Nevada, there was a lot of stuff that I could do. The AWA back then was running shows at the show, the TV tapings at the Showboat. So there was a lot of, for a young wrestler. And then, you know, I was also lucky enough to do WWF TV tapings in the day, you know, when it was still the WWF. And through all of that experience and stuff like that, it really helped out a lot. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, money was tight, you know, because, you know, you're an undercard guy, you're a beginning kid, and you're a rookie, and, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money. But there was a lot of actual real promotions, and they all had good name headliners and stuff that were working at the time. So there was still that organized big promotional feeling, as opposed to, you know, the WWE and, you know, TNA and Lucha Underground. And you've got, you know, the next biggest one, I guess, would be Ring of Honor. And then the rest are all independent promotions that are, you know, sadly just struggling to survive the way things are today.
Now, one of the people that you came across early in your career is now wreaking havoc up in our neck of the woods in the Northwest. You came across some people that were managed by one Time Traveler. What can you tell us about the Time Traveler that fans up here may not know?
Well, the Time Traveler has been managing wrestlers since the early 80s. And he probably was one of the greasiest, underhanded individuals that you would ever want to cross paths with. There was also a lot, and you know him very well, I assume, so then you know that he's not all there. So the elevator goes to the top, but I don't think the light works all the time. He is somebody that, you know, for wrestlers and for fans, if they get an opportunity to actually talk to him outside of a show, he is an amazing resource of knowledge related to wrestling, to this business. You know, so as crazy and as wild as he is, and the stuff that he says on the microphone, if someone was to actually sit and talk with him, he has probably, you know, 150 years, at least 100 years of wrestling knowledge all over the place. He's phenomenally knowledgeable.
As I mentioned at the start of the show, coming up to our area tomorrow for our big cage match, Chief Atakulakula. I know that you've come across the big chief in your day as well. What's some of the memories you have of Chief Atakulakula?
You know, Chief, I've wrestled Chief. We've feuded a few times. I've also been a wrestling promoter and booked him. One of the things I can tell you about Chief is as far as a wrestler goes, one of the most professional guys you're ever going to come across. He is knowledgeable about the business. He is extremely professional in what he does. He doesn't miss bookings. And one of the other things, too, he's, you know, people may not realize, but he's as tough. He's tougher than a $2 steak. I'm going to tell you what. He is one of the toughest guys that I ever ever got in the ring with. He's literally, literally hard as steel. And, you know, just goes to show, you know, he's been doing this now for God, near 30 years, you know, and he's still in there, and he does knockdown, drag-out fights with people on a nightly basis. That's just an example of how tough this guy is. His opponent better not underestimate him, I tell you that much.
Absolutely not. The Chief, one of the best still. Now, Chief tomorrow night is in a steel cage match. I'm sure in your career you have been in a steel cage a few times. What's your opinion on steel cage matches and what they bring to the table?
You know, I think that a cage match is, it depends on how it's perceived. It's dependent on the rules of the cage match. You know, in the end, I think one of the things is that, you know, cage matches were created because you had two guys that were feuding with each other. They couldn't stand each other, and usually one guy or the other kept getting away, you know, kept running away, kept leaving, kept scooting out, you know, cheap shot at him and then took off. The cage was created for a way to keep them from getting away from each other so that once and for all you would finally have a solution, an ending to this feud that was going on. I think in the aspects of cage matches, I like the old traditional thought process of a cage match where pinfall and submission are what wins the match, that the cage is an implement, a weapon, but that the cage is designed to keep people out and to keep these two together. You know, I like that aspect. When you start throwing in, you got to get out of the cage, the first person's feet to touch the ground and everything, you know, it kind of takes away from what a cage match is, which is designed to keep two guys together. You know, it's definitely a feud ender. But I can tell you, too, that physically on your body, because a lot of cages over the years and stuff that they have, a lot of cages are not like the WWE's $10,000 cages or $20,000 cages. Most of the time, you're going to be in a cage match with rough metal and steel and chicken wire and stuff like that. You're going to get cut. You're going to get torn up. You're going to get scraped up. And if there's any real major rigidity to it at all, when you hit the ropes and hit it, it hurts. It's a physically demanding match, you know, it takes a lot out of you.
Just in the matches that you've had in your own career, what would you say has been the toughest stipulation match that you've been a part of so far?
I've probably, over the course of my career, had done, 40, 50 or more chain matches where you're tied to each other with a steel chain. To me, chain matches are probably the hardest thing to do, to kind of deal with. You have to get yourself into the frame of mind. You know, I mean, I've wrestled in rings where, you know, there were barbed wire wrapped around the rope, and, you know, of course you're going to hit it and it's going to hurt. But chain matches, you not only have to think about what you're doing and how you're moving and where you're going and where you're at in the ring, but, you know, chain matches are hard. They hurt. They're stiff, you know? And I don't care how many people, you know, say, oh, it's phony and it's a work and stuff like that. You know, you get hit through a course of a chain match, I guarantee you at least once, more than once, quite a few times you're going to get your bell rung, you're going to get hit, it's going to hurt. You know, to me, chain matches, probably the most painful out of anything that, you know, out of any specialty match that I've ever had to work. Strap matches are tough, too. Indian strap matches are tough because, you know, there isn't anything about it. You're going to get torn up and, you know, the strap's going to tear you up and you're going to get marks and welts from getting hit with the strap. But the chain matches, you know, hurt. They really do. It's, no matter how you approach it. To me, always the most punishing thing was is, you know, being strapped to another guy with 15 feet of steel chain.
One of the trends here in the Northwest among wrestlers is a post-match antioxidant tea. We're seeing a lot of tea drinkers in the locker rooms these days up in our area. Is tea drinking something that you've ever seen in your area throughout your career, people trying to cleanse themselves after a match?
The only person I remember drinking tea is Lord Alfred Hayes. It's the only one I remember drinking tea at a show is Lord Alfred Hayes. You know, hey, man, I was backstage when, like, you know, Andre would go out and the WWF and would wrestle a match against Randy Savage and come back and drink three bottles of wine. So, you know, not a lot of tea drinking when I was in the backstage area afterwards. But I do know that I noticed that, like, the newer generations of wrestlers and stuff today, there is a lot of the top-notch guys, the real well-known, the guys that are working all over the country, guys like Damian Wayne Costell and Ricochet and, you know, those guys and stuff, man, there's such a dedication to fitness and performance that, you know, they really take a lot of time to take care of themselves before and afterwards. So, you know, doing some detoxification and stuff, I'm not surprised at that at all. We didn't have it a lot in our locker room. It was like, okay, the show's over with, let's go have a beer. That was kind of it. But the new kind of performance athlete of pro wrestling of today, the real successful ones, those tend to spend a lot of time as far as making sure that their diet's clean and they're taking in good stuff and that they're doing post-recovery, you know, stuff like that, you know. Damian Wayne Costell is a prime example of that. He's one of those guys that, you know, he takes care of himself. You know, he's in his 40s and he looks phenomenal and he still works well, you know. So he's one that really takes care of himself before and after.
You referenced the times that you were with the WWF doing a television tapings and so forth. What were the differences like working for an organization like the WWF compared to what your normal bookings were around that time frame?
Well, the WWF, you got to realize the TV tapings are special. And TV tapings, a little bit different now, because the way it used to work was, you know, tapings were about once a month. TV tapings were about once a month. And it would be two towns. Back to back. For example, California, it was always San Francisco at the Cow Palace, and the next night was in Sacramento at the Arco Arena. In Arizona, one night would be in Phoenix at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, the next night would be in Tucson. TV tapings, they always ran towns close to each other back to back. Over the course of a night of TV tapings, a TV taping night would be 4 hours. A show would be 4 hours. They would do 3 hours worth of, you know, the short job matches where all the guys are focused. You see matches of all the guys and they're going up against, you know, a jobber like me or somebody else, you know, and they have their match, their short match, and it's that match is over with. And then they bring the next one out and they bring the next one out. And at the time as a job guy that I was and stuff, some of us would end up working two or three times in a night, especially if you had a gimmick where you had a hood as well as without. And I think the whole thing was very, very nice. There was always, you know, catering. There was always food there for us so we could get a good meal beforehand. There was lots of, you know, there was lots of areas in the arenas that you could go change. And there was a real general camaraderie. All the guys, even, you know, I'm sitting changing and getting dressed and stuff like that, and Hulk Hogan's right next to me, and Randy Savage is over here in the corner and stuff like that. There wasn't an isolation. Everybody was, you know, changing together, kind of like, you know, independent shows now. But there was, you know, they took really good care of you, and of course the money was good, but it was a long night. You were looking at two really, really long nights, you know, 3 to 4 hours one show, 3 to 4 hours another show. You know, it was do the show. After the show was over, get a little bit of sleep, get in the car, go to the next town, you know, and do the same thing that night. And then, okay, we'll see you in about a month. So it's not like it is now. There's, you know, TV tapings, what, Monday and Tuesday and stuff like that. And they're working every week like that. And then they have like 4 days off or 3 days off. Now these guys are, you know, back then those guys were working every single night. And, you know, every 4 weeks was two nights of TV tapings where they got everything done. So everything you saw on Superstars and, you know, and Monday night with, you know, Gorilla and Heenan and stuff like that. Those things were, you know, all those matches were done over the course of two nights. So that's kind of how it happens. So so definitely different than the independent shows of today where, you know, guys just find a place to sit. Everybody changes together and, you know, kind of just the way it is. But you were definitely taken – they took good care of you during TV tapings.
One of the other aspects in wrestling that has been a little bit controversial in the last year or so is intergender matches. The state of New York trying to stop a match from happening because it was intergender before finally allowing it to happen. There's been people on both sides of the fence on if they're something that should be happening in this day and age. What's your stance on the intergender matches?
Well, I think, you know, there was a time there, I think it's this perceived impression that, you know, women are, you know, weaker than men and, you know, you shouldn't be attacking her, this, that, or the other. You know, people don't realize that there have been intergender matches for years and years and years. You know, I remember Mae Young in the heyday, like in the 40s and 50s, Mae Young, there would be guys that would come up and challenge. At the time, the women's champion was Mildred Burke. And there were men that would actually challenge for money to wrestle Mildred Burke, and they'd have to face Mae Young, and Mae would stretch them. You know, there's been a lot of – I think in other countries, you've seen a lot of intergender stuff over the years. And I can tell you many, many a times I worked mixed tag matches over the years. Usually a show would draw heat to a semi-main event of a mixed tag team match. And, you know, so I don't know. I think that with the girls and stuff that you have now, and there's a lot of really good female talent out there, I think having them compete in those matches against men, I think it's entertaining. If you do it right, It's a really, really good, entertaining show. I've seen Joey Ryan do some great stuff with some other female wrestlers and stuff like that. That just really the house loves. So you know, I'm all for it because I've known quite a few gals in my time that were tough as any guys I'd ever known.
Oh. In your career, have you done a lot of intergender wrestling? Did you have a history of tag teaming with women or one-on-one matches with them?
Never a one-on-one match per se, but I've done a lot of mixed tag matches. A lot of shows did a lot of mixed tag matches. I remember one night doing a mixed tag match where it was me and a female partner and a midget wrestler as a partner. And we went up against another team on the other side of a male, a female, and a midget. So, you know, I mean, those kind of specialty matches like that have been around for years. You know, they were much, much more prevalent, actually, in like the 40s and the 50s. You saw a lot of intergender stuff. You know, people, I don't know if people, you know, go back and remember any of that and stuff and go back because there's probably not a lot of stuff anymore available to see, but there used to be in the day in the 50s and the 40s, there was a lot of intergender stuff because just having it on a card drew a crowd. The house went nuts. People were like, oh, woman's going to be in the ring with a man. Oh, I've got to go see that. That would get a butt on a seat, you know? And yeah, I've done a lot of, I don't know how many, but I've done a bunch of intergender matches. I've had like, you know, partners like, Satin Doll and Cheryl Russo, Little Mo, cheerleader Melissa, you know, lots of gals, you know, in Mexico, quite a few, you know, in intergender matches. I've done quite a few of them. It usually is something to just, they usually use it as something to really draw people in on a poster. Oh, the girl's going to be in the ring with the guy and everything and stuff. And in the day, it used to sell tickets. It used to draw on attention. But, of course, you had to keep them there. You had to give them a good match, you know. And I always had fun. We always had fun because it's easy to sell and put somebody over that's the same size as you, you know, that's another big guy like yourself. It's very easy to put somebody over like that, and you're in the ring with them. It's much harder. It takes a lot more skill to make somebody who's, you know, 150 pounds less than you and, you know, a foot shorter than you, you know, look good and hit you with stuff and set it up so that you hit you with stuff and you bump forward and everything like that. That takes a lot more work, I think, to make somebody much smaller than you, you know, look like they could survive and hold their own with you.
Now, there were young people today that wanted to get into the wrestling business. What would be your recommendations on where to go to get trained?
I think, you know, a reputable school is important, and there are, you know, lots of schools throughout the country. You know, I know Dory Funk Jr. has a school in Texas. I know Harley Race has a school. I know in the West Coast here, in the Western area, Scott Casey has a school in Nevada, in Las Vegas. I know that there are several schools in California. Jesse Hernandez is the School of Hard Knocks in California. Jesse's been in the business for, you know, gosh, almost 50 years. So my first suggestion is, and now with the internet, and you can read reviews and people writing about stuff in posts, now it's a lot easier to find a good, reputable school, you know. And that's the first thing. Find a reputable school with a head trainer and an assistant trainers that have been working in the business and have a lot of experience working on the road, being on TV, stuff like that. Those are the places you want to go to. You know, Harley Race doesn't get in the ring and teach guys anymore. But Harley Race is down there at ringside talking to you, telling you stuff, giving you education. You know, Dory Jr. is the same way, giving you education. Jesse Hernandez is the same way. Getting in there with somebody that's been in the business for a long time with a lot of knowledge and has a well-established school, that's the first step. That is absolutely the most important thing in the world. Do your research, because if you're wanting to be a professional wrestler, if this is a dream for you, do your research. Find the one that's the most reputable school in your area and go and talk to them. And go and see them and go and take a look at the school, too. Also, make sure that you have a foundation set where you are you have money available, you know, so that you're not going to go hungry. If you're going to go, just go to school and not do anything else, then make sure that you got a grub stake put together, that you got money put together. Because wherever you're going to, you know, is going to need to have an apartment. You're going to need to stay there. You're going to need to pay groceries and gas and pay for the school and everything. So if you're not going to work there, make sure you've got a good, you know, a good stake set up. Also, make sure that you are physically ready to go and do it. There are tons of guys that I've seen go to pro wrestling schools, and I've ran and had pro wrestling schools, a couple in the Valley over the years. I don't anymore, though. But I can tell you that one of the biggest things that I've ever seen is guys coming in, they're not in shape, they're not fit, they have no cardio, and they're not ready to learn and be in the shape to learn when they go through school. Pro wrestling training is extremely physically demanding. If you're not willing to do the minimum and be in shape when you go to school on day one, then maybe the business isn't, pro wrestling isn't for you. Because remember, the fitness and the training and everything, that's a job requirement. That's not paying your dues. That's a job requirement. You need to have that done before and be ready to go day one. You should be fit enough to step into school and take anything that they're going to throw at you.
At this point in time, my co-host QT is standing by, and I know that he has questions also, so I'm going to pass things over to QT.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, CeCe.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. CeCe, we usually ask our first-timers on the show the standard question, what's the hardest knife-edge chop you've ever received in this business?
Oh, easy. Hands down. Ronnie Garvin.
Wow.
Ronnie Garvin. Ronnie Garvin, Wahoo McDaniel has a serious chop. There was another guy in the Southwest. He wrestled for years, never made it nationally. His name was Jody Arnold. He used to tear you up on chops. But I will swear on a stack of Bibles, Ronnie Garvin will take skin off of your chest.
Ronnie Garvin, hardest chop ever.
Yes. And he's a hell of a nice guy, too, and he's a wonderfully nice and sweet guy. So he's nice to you when he's kicking your ass, which is special. But, Ronnie Garvin, hardest chop ever.
Wow, all right. How would you compare his chop with Chief Atakula Kula's?
Chief hits you. Garvin's hands were very, very tough, and his calluses on his hand would take the skin off of your chest. Chief has these big, thick, meaty hands, these big old ham hocks. Getting hit in the chest with Chief is kind of like getting hit in the chest with a club. So it's much more solid, but much more heavy. But I'm going to tell you what, Garvin's were heavy, and the skin on his hands just tore your skin off of your chest. Absolutely tore the skin off of your chest.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. I'm going to mark that in my logbook. Okay. Now, CeCe, did you freestyle wrestle in high school, and was this in Arizona?
Yeah, I started out – I was on the mats when I was – first time I was on the mats, I was probably 5 or 6. Out here, they used to have what they called Sunkissed Kids, which was a national thing of amateur freestyle wrestling. And Sunkissed Kids, and so I wrestled as a kid in elementary school, outside of elementary school itself, but in the Sunkissed Kids, I went to, there were summertime wrestling programs that you went through. Bobby Douglas, who was an NCAA champion and Olympian, one of the best amateur wrestling coaches in history. Bobby Douglas, every summer for a month, had his school. Had his training camps, and I went to Bobby Douglas's camps every summer. I wrestled in junior high school. I wrestled in high school. I had that amateur wrestling background, not only freestyle wrestling, but Greco-Roman as well. I had that background before I ever even got into the business.
As a freshman in high school, did you start out at the 160-pound class? That's my guess.
That's good. I think I was 160. You know what? I think I was like 145, and then 141, and then because I was walking around about 145 and cut to 141 for the weight class. But I think, I was that for one season. When I at 16, when I became a sophomore, I was really lifting a lot, and my weight just started to go up. So that. By the time I was a junior, I was wrestling at 205.
Wow.
And then my senior year, I was a heavyweight.
Oh,
I was a light heavyweight. I was like 220. I was a lean, 218. I was a lean heavyweight. And there was a lot of heavyweights there in the state at the time that I wrestled against that were 260, 270, stuff like that. So I was a lighter heavyweight, but no, by the time I was a senior, because I was also wrestling and training with, Paavo Kitonen and learning, as a catch wrestler was taught, which actually came in handy when I was in high school wrestling, I'd be on the mat with guys, and knowing how to hook comes in handy when you're on the mat. You can put guys in a lot of pain and get them to lay over on their back and kind of give up. That was a benefit. But, yeah, I started, I think I was like 141, and then around 16, I hit a growth spurt. And then all of a sudden, just with the weightlifting and the training that I was doing and everything, I just got bigger fast.
You mentioned the name Paavo Tuitonen. Is that Finnish?
No, Tuitonen. It's K-E-E-T-O-N-E-E-N. And Paavo was, I think Paavo was Sicilian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But he was probably 65 when I started in the business, you know, in the 80s. He had wrestled in the 40s and in the 50s. He'd wrestled guys like, you know, like I said, Vic Christie and Lou Fez, Danny Hodge. You know, he was an old school. And a lot of these guys, when it comes to the history of pro wrestling, a lot of these guys got all their start in carnivals. You know, I don't know how familiar you guys are with about the old days of pro wrestling.
Well, we know about, of course, Lou Thesz. And then none other than Abraham Lincoln was rumored to have wrestled in a carnival. Yes.
Yeah. In the day, guys used to wrestle to settle differences. You know, but they used to do in the old days, in the 20s, 1910, 1890s, in the 20s to the 30s, they did what they had, carnivals, touring carnivals would go around, and they would have what they called at shows, athletic shows. Now, the athletic show had a strongman, and it had an acrobat, and it had, you know, a boxer or two, and it had a wrestler or two. And they would take challenges from people coming in and they would take challenges on wrestling the guys that were coming into town and say the toughest wrestler that's in town, you know, Billy Joe's, he's tougher than anybody. Well, here's our guy. He can come in and face him and we'll make bets on him. And at the at shows, your wrestlers, you had a few different types of wrestlers. There were different classifications. Your first one was your journeyman. The journeyman was somebody that, you know, was, you know, a good knowledge of, you know, wrestling and was an entertainer and was a performer and stuff. And that was about his level. But there were a lot of great journeymen. You know, Buddy Rogers was world champion and he was a journeyman. Then your next level up was your shooter. And your shooter was somebody that usually he made his way in the amateur ranks and he was working as a pro to make money. He had good amateur wrestling and could control somebody and take them down and stuff like that. And then at the top of the food chain, you had a hooker. A hooker was the guy that was a great amateur wrestler. He had all that knowledge of freestyle and Greco-Roman wrestling, but he also knew a bunch of holds that we call hooks, crippling holds that can tear people apart, break necks, arms, legs. That evolved into what we call catch wrestling. Catch wrestling is one that's, you know, being – you know, you hear a lot about when, like, MMA fighter Josh Barnett is out there because he's a catch wrestler. Neil Melanson, who trains the Black Zillions, he's a catch wrestler. But in the day, the hooker was the top of the food chain. Guys like Lou Thesz, guys like Danny Hodge, and Paavo was one of those type of guys. So Paavo had a knowledge of not only about professional wrestling, he had a tremendous knowledge of how to hurt people. And how to use holds and do hooks to take care of anybody that you're dealing with. And that was a knowledge that came to me that came in real handy because I'd come into a territory or something and a guy would be – there would be certain top guys that are there or there would be guys that would give you an attitude and test you. And if you were able to hold your own or if you were able to teach them a lesson, you got respect. When I wrestled in Japan – the Japanese wrestlers, they would test you to see if you knew what you were doing, you know, and if you were able to hold your own, you got their respect and you got treated differently than the guys that couldn't. So, you know, that knowledge base was what was taught to me when I started. And I'm truly grateful that I got that opportunity. It made a real difference into the wrestler that I became.
Hey, wow, not that you definitely know your history. CeCe, is there anything, is there any category known as a micro hooker, someone that you need to peer under the microscope for to see his talents, like me?
You know, it's funny, there's so many of them that there are guys that everybody always had some type of hold, you know, something that they could always go to, their what they call their sugar hold. That was their thing that they could always go to. But, you know, to find real tough guys, real guys that could really do it, that started to disappear more and more over the 80s and into the 90s because, you know, pro wrestling has changed so much. It is so much more of a, you know, it has evolved over the years into so much about performance and showmanship and less about the knowledge of wrestling and holds and, you know, being able to do those things. It's so much more about showmanship now. You know, one of the guys that's been in the business for years and years and years in the South, a guy named Q-Ball Carmichael, who's been a friend of mine for a long time. He, you know, it's like all these guys, his whole problem is everybody wants to fly off the top rope. Nobody wants to learn how to do a double wrist lock. You know, So I think that there's a kind of a detachment, I think, with guys today. Now, don't get me wrong. I respect talents, guys like Ricochet and stuff like that. These guys are amazing athletic performers. You know, I know guys like Jim Cornette kind of bash them sometimes. He calls them all flippy-do wrestlers. But there's amazing stuff that they do, just amazing things that they do. But I think that a lot of times there's a disconnect from guys wanting to learn how to do all that stuff and not wanting to learn how to wrestle. That's one of the things that I see that's really difficult for new generations. You know, we learned how to wrestle before we ever hit ropes. We were wrestling, you know, before we ever came off of a rope, before we ever body slammed anybody, we were wrestling, you know? So it's like, oh, what are you trying to do? Climb up on that rope? You better learn how to do a wrist lock first. You better learn how to do a waist lock takedown. You better know how to do a duck under to a toe hold. Those things are, you know, wrestling, and it seems like a lot of times that some of that gets missed today, where there's so much of a focus on the biggest high spot that I can do. The little things, you know, really can make a difference. And I think sometimes that's where we see a disconnect from the generation that I was a part of to the generation of performers that you see now.
Yes, even a Russian leg sweep, you should learn how to do that before you climb the ropes. Russian leg sweep.
Well, yeah, and there's just traditional wrestling. If two guys get in and can wrestle a match and keep the crowd watched and entertained and not hit the ropes once, that's a couple of guys that are extremely talented and can do whatever they want to do. If you have if you're able to tell a story without 500 high spots, you've got an advantage over somebody that needs that to tell a story, because you can always go to that. You know what I'm saying? It's a foundation. If you have a strong foundation and you build a house on it, the house is going to stand up and it's going to hold up and it's going to last for a long time. If you don't have a strong foundation, you build it on swampland, the house is going to sink. I mean, and that's real simple. Just, you know, I think so many guys want to focus on being in the center of the ring under the lights with thousands of people watching. They're not focusing on the work you have to do to get there.
Oh, okay.
You know, you don't
yeah,
get
I agree
to be,
with that, yes.
Yeah, you don't get to be somebody like Ricochet. You know, Prince Puma and Lucha Underground, you don't get to be somebody like that, you know, that's main eventing all over the country, all over the world. You don't get to be somebody like that without having a crazy strong foundation. And he does. He has an amazing wrestling foundation as well. And that's one of the things that makes him so good. You know, he can do the incredible aerial maneuvers that, you know, I mean, I see and they just take my breath away. I'm amazed by him. But, you know, but but he also has a strong foundation. He has a strong ability to wrestle. He can work a headlock. You know, he can work a wrist lock. He can do those things. And I think a lot of times everybody wants to be a superstar, but they don't want to put the work in to get there. You know, you have to build that foundation if you want to really be successful.
Well, one of the men that we had on at Turnbuckle Turmoil, we had done the good fortune of having on several months ago, and he is an original Sun-Kissed Kid. We had on MMA competitor and professional wrestler Dan the Beast Severn, who was an Arizona State University alumni and is an instructor in self-defense courses for law enforcement officers. Did you ever have a chance to meet Dan the Beast Severn?
I actually know Dan pretty well. Dan has a house out here in Scottsdale. Dan is, you know, Dan's probably, when it comes back to old school tough guys, Dan is probably one of the toughest that you'll ever see. But you know what? The nice thing is I was actually in Vegas when he was honored by the Cauliflower Alley Club and got the Luthez Award. A lifetime achievement award for wrestling. I was there for that. He's an amazing, well, you've gotten a chance to talk to him, so you know. First of all, he's an extremely intelligent individual. But if you get a chance to really talk to him personally, I hope you guys have, you find out what a really nice guy he is. You know, he really is a nice guy.
Yeah.
And that's the one of the legends, I guess, like, you know, Theodore Roosevelt said it. He walks softly, but he carries a majorly big stick, you know? But if you're somebody that can thump anybody who wants to, like, you know, like Dan Severn, you don't have to cluck like a rooster. He's a really good guy. Yeah, I have a tremendous amount of respect for him.
Now, CC, I was, even though he won a NCAA title for Arizona State University, and he lectures a lot on their campus, both Sign Guy and myself were stunned to find out that the on-campus cafeteria doesn't offer him free bowls of soup. Would you join our Turnbuckle Turmoil efforts to get Dan Severn free bowls of soup at ASU? Would you join us?
Absolutely. I am 100% behind you. Dan Severn above everybody should deserve free soup, dang it. I think that's fair. Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
He should walk on campus, and they should just give him bowls of soup just saying thank you, I think.
Yes, yes. They should have a lookout for Dan Severn coming on campus, and then security can call this waiter, and this waiter could come with a silver platter with a bowl of soup on it. Yes, that's my goal.
Perfect. And you know what's funny? Because Dan's one of those guys that, you know, was successful in MMA and you know, as an amateur wrestler and became successful as a professional wrestler. My very first match that I ever had was with a guy that started out at pro wrestling and became an MMA champion. My very first match I ever had was with Don Fry.
Oh, wow.
So
my first
pro wrestling match was, I was, what, 17? And Don was going to Arizona State, and he was a wrestler there. And he was working under the gimmick. He was called J.R. Austin. They wanted him to kind of be – he was supposed to be kind of like a Magnum T.A. type of guy because, you know, with that mustache of his. And he has had that mustache forever. You know, he's very, you know, Tom Selleck-like looking, and that's kind of what they were putting at the time. But me and him worked – I think it was a 20-minute draw – in Arizona, actually, for our very first match that we had against each other.
Wow, all right, okay. Oh, well, Sign Guy is a big fan of Magnum P.I., so am I, yes. Okay. Well, CC, I was reading page 19 of a book called Dusty Reflections of an American Dream, and it seemed that Dusty Rhodes was called Dusty Rhodes for a road outside his house in Texas, and a Major League Baseball player named Dusty Rhodes back in the 1950s who was hitting a lot of home runs in the World Series. Can I read you this brief autograph of the American Dream book, Reflections of an
Sure.
American Dream?
Sure.
Oh, okay. And I quote from page 19, "Of course, back then, as I got older, I played in all sports, whether it was football, baseball, basketball, running, jumping, swimming. I was an all-star baseball player, and I had really felt that I would play Major League Baseball. My dad, of course, believed that too, because in 1954, a big star for the New York Giants, Dusty Rhodes, became very famous for hitting home runs in the World Series. Since I've always been called Dusty because of the road outside our house and the fact I hit something like 16 home runs in 18 games one year, we thought that was my destiny. Now, CC, I was researching funny baseball names, wrestling names also, and mostly baseball names, and I came across some baseball names that go back some ways that could be used in the wrestling ring. I would like to get your opinion of these funny baseball players that could be named in the wrestling ring. Are you ready? And see if you agree.
Sure. Okay.
All right, how about Cannonball Titcomb?
That's a great one. Is that a shoot? Is that really a guy that was named that?
Yes, yes. You can look at funny baseball names, and there's Cannonball Titcomb. I believe he was
a that's a great name. That's a great name. That's a name for a lady wrestler. I'm sorry, that's an awesome name.
Oh, okay.
How great would it be some girl coming in with a big brass-covered wrestling top and she tells everybody she's Cannonball Titcomb? That's an awesome gimmick. I love that.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't want to receive a knife-edge chop from her because I couldn't return one. Yes, definitely. Okay. All right, how about Dick Pole?
Pole.
Yes.
Wow. Dick Pole, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. I can see the visual, you know, I can imagine the robe, you know, that he's going to wear to the ring, but, you know, I don't know what his catchphrase would be, you know, without getting his face slapped, but that's an interesting name. I don't know, though. I don't know if the wrestling world's ready for Dick Pole.
Okay, I'm going to put CC recommends this for adult film star. Okay.
That's a great name for an adult film star.
Yes,
definitely.
Okay. All right. How about Stubby Clap?
Stubby what?
Stubby Clap.
Stubby Clat. That's definitely
like
a midget wrestler
clap.
Name. I think that's a good one. Yeah, Stubby Clat. That's a great midget wrestler name, I think.
Oh, okay. All right. And then, of course, you knew Catfish Hunter and Coco Crisp. That goes without saying.
Yes. Those names are definitely familiar. Catfish Hunter and Coco Crisp. Catfish Hunter, I guess it would kind of be a Hillbilly Jim gimmick, I think, you know?
Oh,
have the big,
Hillbilly
the
Jim.
Big hat and the overalls, it'd be Catfish Hunter.
Oh, okay. All right.
And he could literally slap the guys in the head with a catfish to get the win.
Oh, okay, a catfish, all right. A stuffed one, all right. Very good, okay. All right, how about Antonio Bastardo? Bastardo.
Antonio Bastardo.
Yes.
You'd have to tag a neat name to it, like the Latin bastard, Antonio Bastardo, something like that.
Oh, okay.
You know,
kind of like a Lucha
my father
wrestler.
Was a Bastardo, I'm a Bastardo, my grandpa's a Bastardo, and with me you get 100% Bastardo. That would work. I could see that in an interview.
Oh, very nice. Okay, we're on a roll here. Okay. All right, how about Boots Poffenberger?
Poffenberger.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe he could be one of the exoticos in Lucha Libre. We could call him Boots Poffenberger. And he could come out with, like, you know, poofs and stuff like that, I guess. I don't know if that one would work in the wrestling game, though. I like the name, but I don't know if it would work in the business, though.
Oh, all right. Okay, I'm going to put a double star by that one. Unsure. Okay, very good.
You know,
okay.
there's also when it comes to names, you know, there's also a history of guys and promoters naming guys' names just to do it as a rib, right? Have you ever heard of that one?
Yes.
Because did you ever hear the story of Terry Funk when he was running Amarillo? One of the ribs he played on one of his new wrestlers.
No, what was that?
There was a guy who was wrestling for him, and he needed a name, so he decided that he would name him Jack Chit, C-H-I-T.
Oh.
Jack Chit. So he'd introduce him, it's Jack Chit. And the whole crowd would start chanting, "We want Chit, we want Chit, we want Chit." And he just did it as a rib, and the guy got through it, and they made him do it for like a week and everything. And he's like, "Please give me a different name." So he said, "Okay, I'll give you a different name. From now on, you're going to be called Mike Chit." So he changed his name from Jack Chit to Mike Chit. So Mike Chit was the guy, and everybody in the crowd ended up chanting, "We want Chit, we want Chit, we want Chit." So names have been given to guys. Wrestling names have been given to guys as a rib as well.
Ooh,
that
Bruce
Puffenberger, I think that would be a good rib name for one of the guys.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, very good. I'll note that. Okay. And the last one, boy, we're quickly running out of time. How about Vinegar Bandit Mizell?
Vinegar Bandit Mizell. If that isn't a pro wrestling name, I don't know what is. The Vinegar Bandit. That's awesome. He could come walking in with a giant douchebag and, like, spray guys in the face with it. He's the Vinegar Bandit. That's brilliant. That would have worked in the WWE's extreme time frame when they were, you know, doing the adult stuff. The Vinegar Bandit, that would have been great. You could have had, like, a scene backstage where, like, Trish Stratus and Lita come walking out. Hey, I'm missing something, and I don't feel as fresh, and then the Vinegar Bandit comes running by. That would be awesome.
Wow, yeah, sign guy, I think we have a new segment on our show. Yeah, very nice. Okay, baseball players and wrestling, okay. Well, I have a bigger list I'd love to go over, but we're running out of time, so I'm unfortunately going to turn it back over to sign guy. Yes.
All right, thank you, QT. Well, like QT said, Mr. Star, we're running out of time, so I want to give the last few minutes to you. If there's anything you would like to say to the listeners, plug and promote absolutely anything at all that you would like, floor is all yours.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I'm really grateful for the time that you guys asked me actually to come and talk to you. I really do appreciate it. I'm very, very grateful. I really don't have anything to plug, but you guys are aware, and we talked this week. I lost my father, and my dad was a big fan of the business and loved me for everything that I went through in spite of it. For any guy that's out there that's aspiring to be a pro wrestler, going for your dreams and everything I think is great, but never forget to spend time with your family, who got you there, you know, your parents and stuff like that, being there for them. Because I tell you, I've been all over the world, but I tell you, I would turn in every belt I've ever won and every road trip I've ever done and every crowd that I performed in front of for just one more day with my father. And when you're on the road and you're trying to make a name for yourself or you're trying to get into the business or whatever, a lot of times people forget their, you know, the most important things in the world to them, their family. And if you have that, don't ever let that go and always appreciate, you know, the ones that are there for you. So, you know, as far as a plug, if you have a chance this week to all the listeners, hug your parents and tell them that you love them because you never know when a day is going to come and they're not going to be there.
All right. Well, CC Star, it was a pleasure to have you on the show today. Hopefully we'll get the chance to do this again in the not-so-distant future. I want to wish you and your family well. And thanks for taking the time today to be with us.
Gentlemen, it has been an absolute pleasure. I would love to do this anytime. I'm at your disposal. Thank you so much for everything, and I wish you guys the absolute best, okay?
Thank you, CC.
All right, you guys, take care.
All right, well, fans, there's wrestling out there. Get out there, support some local independent shows this week, wherever they may be near you. We will be back with you Sunday afternoon. We have the one-man Armageddon, Damon Crowe, scheduled for Sunday. Should be an outstanding time with him. So join us then. Get out there, support your local independents. Sunday afternoon, we will also all be down in Portland, Oregon, to honor DeMarcus James as he enters the Turnbuckle Turmoil Hall of Fame 2017 inductee. So DeMarcus will be on hand at NWA Blue Collar. All of the Turnbuckle staff, minus our women's expert, will be there to personally present him with the plaque. So make sure if you're anywhere near Portland, you come out and support that. DeMarcus, well deserving of this. And we will be back with you Sunday afternoon.
Talking in sleep.